you say something about, and maybe this is just me, the dichotomy between the formal practice of Zazen, and then once you're sitting in Zazen, and then I can't get the right verb, but the need to then allow whatever comes up to come up. So the sort of the free flowingness and the formality and the contradiction between the two. Please.
Is there a contradiction between the two?
I feel there is. I feel.
Where do you feel the contradiction? Where in your body?
In the posture of sitting upright, the tension of sitting upright. The feeling grounded down here at the base, and then the sort of growing taller up here. Somewhere in the middle.
Interesting. Heaven.
And oh, yeah.
Between heaven and earth.
Yeah.
We're bound to feel pulled in two directions, aren't you?
If you believe in heaven and earth, I just started watching The Good Place. That's quite funny. If you've come across that.
No.
Anyway, that's beside the point.
Do you think maybe what you're describing is something that just happens? That we're pulled between two things?
Yes. Is it? Does anyone else feel
that?
Just me.
Oh, I felt it. Especially the last lesson. Yes.
I mean, but it's also the sort of formality of coming into the room in a particular way, you know, the form of the formality of the form, which is fine. I don't have a problem with it because I think it's got a value, and in a sense, having that formality gives one the freedom to allow the chaos to emerge, if you like.
Chaos.
Yeah, it gives it a frame. To me,
that's something about the act of disciplining or controlling.
Mm.
Isn't that what controlling is?
Yep.
Trying to put a container around chaos, something like that.
Drawing the chaos into relief so that it can be seen to be flowing, as opposed to just overwhelming and sort of.
Where's it flowing?
Through time.
Okay.
We live on the cusp of time. Maybe the metaphor's getting messed up here.
So the kind of ongoing, chaotic something.
Mm. Arising.
Arising. Well, you mean like all the stuff in your consciousness coming and going?
Yes.
And the kind of physical control that you're imposing on yourself with the posture.
Mm. I think I'm answering my own question. Aren't I?
No, I think I experience that.
Right.
To me, that's. I mean, if I think back to another physical discipline which requires control, for me, it was rock climbing. It was very, very much that.
You're contained.
Because you're scared.
Yeah,
for example.
There is the chaos of falling potentially.
Yes.
In rock climbing, and the fact that
you. But you control it.
Mm.
Or you exert self-control.
Yes.
Well, maybe what you described is process of self-control.
Mm.
Which is, my teacher used to say, zazen is self-control.
To some extent it's coming from the outside, because it's the form that's exerting the control, but then I'm giving into the form, I suppose.
Isn't it also that you have to be more aware, or you are more aware, because they are not moving around, you're not distracting yourself, there's no other input, so you're just there, so you're more aware of what is happening, the sensations in your body and the things in your mind. So it's not just that you are controlling it, that you are aware of what is happening, while in your normal life you're not so aware.
Mm.
And then you sort of exert control in not running away or moving or cheating or whatever. But it's that you're more aware, for me.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and having the timekeeper, who always seems to die during the sessions.
Oh, he's cruel.
He is.
Sadistic streak.
Yeah.
You have to be a timekeeper. Please, please, ring the bell now.
Did you ever feel daggers in your back, Tom?
But it's true, taking that power away, I can't get up until the bell goes.
Well, you can.
Yeah.
So we agree to not to get up.
We agree not to. And I mean, having an automatic timer at home, you know, giving Tom a break.
We give the job of to Tom of disciplining us.
Or
making us stay until
up
his turn.
Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you, Tom.
Why do you do it? In rock climbing, did anybody ever tell you to loosen up? Because like, zazen is quite unusual that I'm supposed to not be too tight, I'm supposed to let things arise. Usually it's like, you're gonna rest after 5 p.m. You're gonna rest after you get to the top in 1 hour. Like, if you're climbing for maybe for a week, it makes sense to preserve energy. But if you're just climbing for 1 hour, you can grab tight.
Can you?
Don't know.
What are you imagining?
Don't know. Bouldering, I can grab tight for an hour, and then I'm exhausted.
Oh, no, I think even in bouldering, you have to learn to relax your body. Otherwise, you can't do that for more than maybe 5 minutes maximum. So you learn to relax your body and distribute your weight. So there's tense areas of the body, like you've got to keep your feet, your ankles rigid because you're putting your weight on, or your arms, but the rest of the body you have to learn to relax. And I suppose it's the same with karate.
Yeah.
So it's strange, really.
You have to snatch tiny little bits of relaxation in between tension, or you just seize up very quickly.
Yeah. And of course, that's what you learn in zazen.
Mm.
the guy who did the wonderful task with Nishijima of translating the Shobo Genzo, Mike Cross, Chodo Cross, I told you he started off in Okinawa studying Goju Ryu karate.
Mm.
When he came to zazen, he was a young 25-year-old, powerful young man looking for enlightenment.
Mm.
And he started practicing zazen, and he would sit like this.
And he did, and he was so, he was so committed, and that he did that for a very long time, and he couldn't do it anymore. He had to stop.
Yeah.
And he met an Alexander teacher, who said to him, "No, no, no, that's not it."
Yeah. Yeah.
So you you can't practice zazen like that.
Yeah.
Although I've been to groups where they tell you to.
Yeah.
That's, to me, that's not zazen. How can you enter any peaceful gate if you're so yes, it's quite interesting.
It's some sort of combination of a discipline and a relaxation at
yes.
the same time, kind of what Dave's saying is trying to get some sort of balance and yin and yang of the two together.
Yes, yes.
Because you need both.
And you might have found, I think everybody finds when you start to sit, you're not quite sure whether a straight back is like that or whether it's like that. Well, actually, it's neither. It's somewhere in between. And you learn, it's like ice skating, you know, that way or that way. But slowly you learn to balance in the middle. So it's the same with everything. When you first practice zazen, you say, oh, I'll sit like this then. You know, arching your back almost. Oh, that's okay. Oh, no, it's not. That's okay. Oh, no, that's not either. And you alternate between the two, maybe for months or even years, until suddenly you find, if you continue to do it regularly, that there seems to be another position that you find. You only find it by having the two other positions. And the same with the hands, and the same with the eyes. You might find yourself, when you first start zazen, am I supposed to look at the wall? You know, or am I supposed to let my eyes glaze over so I'm not really here? So, you know, sometimes you're looking at the wall and sometimes you're, it's like your eyes are hooded. And so then you wake up again and you look at the wall and then, you know, and then it's gone again. But there's another state in between the two. And the same with the hands. You might push your hands down and you, oh no, that's no good. And you lift them up, oh, that's, my shoulders are aching. So everything you're learning, some middle position. This is why I often use the term balance, because to me, although balance is only an idea, there is something between the two. And to me, zazen is learning everything between the two. And that balance between self-control and the rubbish, churning rubbish, the chattering mind. And when you find that balance, a rare, without doing anything, suddenly it comes into balance, then you feel whole. Maybe only for a minute or something. Oh, this is nice. I will do that tomorrow as well.
Yeah.
So yes, for me, that's very, what you're talking about is very important actually, because it's the two extremes that define
what we're doing.
What we're doing, yeah.
Yeah. Right. Thank you.
And then, you know, there's balance between, oh, I got that lovely peace of state and I want to get it tomorrow, and trying to get it tomorrow, and then you give up on that and you think, oh, no, I just... And then there's a balance between that. So you're always finding the middle, always, long-term and short-term. And to me, that's the meaning of the middle way. There is no way, because there's only now. So finding the middle, what middle now? The middle moment, I don't know. And then if we practice finding the middle, or balance, as I call it, if we practice it once a day or twice a day, then we cannot help it affecting our lives unless we make an effort for it not to. So if when we go home this afternoon you feel quite nice and balanced, but you go out and have a couple of pints this evening and sit on the sofa like this and watch the television until 12 o'clock in the morning, then tomorrow morning you'll probably feel back where you did on Thursday.
Phew.
So we can take away our, we can remove our balanced state just like that. But if we don't remove it, it doesn't go. I mean, we can't help, we go to work or whatever. We can't help it. But if we just practice balance regularly, then it kind of seeps into us. And people often say, how do I bring Zazen into my daily life? Well, I don't know. Don't do it. It's happening. You don't have to do anything. Just stop doing things to take it away. If you stop doing things to take it away, it doesn't go. Well, just by the nature of life in society, it dissipates. But I don't know whether Dogen wrote it, but my teacher used to say, it's like a bell. You practice, dong, the sound continues. But very, very slowly, it dies away. So then you practice again, dong, just to keep that echo going. And if you don't practice regularly, then it goes. And then when you do practice, it comes back. And, so, and then if you don't practice regularly again, it goes again. So you can always get it. You can always practice balance. But the thing about practicing regularly is you can maintain it. And if you maintain it over a period of years, then it affects you. You don't have to do anything. It affects your life. Your life is affected. You don't need to know how. And this is why, what I found puzzling, my teacher used to say, just practice Zazen and everything will be all right. Oh, yeah. What can that possibly mean? Well, it means that if you practice balance and regularly, then your life becomes balanced. Well, it's so too simple, really. It's very simple to say, almost unbelievable, but very difficult to do. As is any practice of balance. It doesn't have to be Zazen. It requires a certain kind of dedication, and then sometimes you need to see some results, don't you, really? What's Zazen done for me? So you need to have some kind of sense that it's having an effect. I don't know how you get that. Ask other people. Maybe you feel a bit more cheerful, or you notice you don't get so depressed, or you stop going to the pub so much, or you find yourself calmer at work.
I find the days get longer.
Days get longer.
Good.
That's age. That's age, Dave.
When I practice regularly, there's more time in the day. Does anyone else get that either? Yeah. Probably because I'm doing less crap. And therefore, there's more time for things of more worth. And I actually find that, yeah, the days are longer.
Right.
In a creative way. Everyone looks completely good.
And you don't have to kind of be peaceful to practice zazen. You can practice zazen when you're drunk. I mean, it's a bit counterproductive, but you don't have to. I can't practice zazen because I'm a bit too stressed out. Well, that's exactly when it's helpful to do it, really. And that's why it's difficult.
That's when you get the discipline coming in. When you really don't want to do it.
I suppose discipline, or I don't know. Something in your body misses it, doesn't it? It's like not cleaning your teeth. I didn't clean my teeth today. So in that sense, it's not a religion at all. I don't think Buddhism's ever been a religion in that sense.
It's almost impossible to gauge the long-term effects of it. What would you measure it against? I mean, I can never think of practicing in terms of something I might get in 20 years' time, whatever, if I keep on doing that. It just doesn't make... It's always a very immediate thing with me, so I know that, I feel better if I sit for half an hour, whatever the circumstances. In the same way that I feel better if I don't have a shower or whatever. It's just that.
No. No, it doesn't solve problems, does it?
Yeah, no. It doesn't make it, I don't know, it starts conflicted with difficult decisions to make and all that stuff. As it was really. I'm just going to get less stressed about the fact that I'm stressed most of the time. But life actually feels a bit muddled and mess, actually. It's kind of how it is, really.
It's how it is, yeah. We think problems are something to be solved and got rid of, but actually problems are our life itself.
Yeah.
That is our life.
Yeah.
Yeah. But as far as the actual physical act of sitting is concerned, because it's quite unusual posture for Western people, especially sitting with your legs crossed, I think yoga is very, very helpful, because we tend to have tight tendons, ligaments. We don't do anything to stretch them. So I think quite a few people do yoga with zazen. I know Ralph, my student friend in Bristol, studied with a Japanese master called Hogen back in the 70s, and they always used to do yoga before zazen. And I do half an hour yoga before zazen in the morning. I don't know why, it just stretches the tendons, and when I sit, I feel nicer.
In San Francisco Zen Center, part of a day retreat is before lunch, everybody is in the Zendo doing yoga.
Okay. Well, it would be a good idea to do on retreats, but we used to do it in Earth Spirit. We had somebody who was a yoga teacher, should have asked you to do it.
Could have done it. Mm-hmm. Do it.
Next time.
Yep.
Simply because, you know, when I noticed when we all sat that first evening, I couldn't see myself, but I could see everybody else, and we're all coming in with the physical tensions. So, you know, somebody's sitting like this, another person sitting like that, and you don't feel it. And then over the 3 days, the tensions slowly drop off, and our postures correct themselves. Mine does too. But yoga can help with that. So I think it's a great thing to do. Of course, it means, you know, half an hour yoga and then half an hour zazen. Oh, God. Well, I'll do 15 minutes yoga and 20 minutes zazen. Or 10 minutes yoga and 30 minutes zazen. Or...
Well, as long as Tom builds it into the schedule.
Yeah.
I didn't write the schedule.
Right. Don't try and escape from your responsibility. We know you're responsible for everything.
I find that zazen makes me more minimalistic, like satisfied with less things. But it's, I mean, Japanese aesthetic is just Japanese aesthetic of, you know, the circle and the stone gardens, but there's something, this is the obvious change that I think from zazen, something I gain from zazen is that I'm satisfied with less. Is it correct?
Well, I don't know. There's a way of looking at our progress through life based on balance, which suggests that what we're doing is getting rid of things, becoming simpler. Taking off layers of what? What kind of layers do we take off? Well, maybe false things that we imagine are true and are not true, ideas about ourself which don't fit with reality, strong ambitions which don't help us. Lots of things that we slowly lose, so it's just, in a way, a minimalist pursuit. As taught by many of the very ancient Christian teachers. I've just written a book about this very thing. Getting rid of things. Stripping off. Returning to something, we can call it simplicity. And for me, that's very important. Yeah.
If you take it back to Zen, it's Shinjin Datsuraku, isn't it? Casting off body and mind.
Casting off body and mind.
Molting.
Yeah. It doesn't mean to become a hermit, although there's an image of Zen monks as hermits. Living in little huts up in the mountains, but you can get rid of things and still live in normal society. And I mean, it's to get rid of wanting things. I don't mean to snuff out desire, which I think is a pointless thing, but just not to want so much is actually quite a relief. I remember when I first went to Japan, I was surrounded by 1970s, 1980s, Japanese technology. It was everything, all those gadgets and I loved everything. I used to go to Zazen on Saturday afternoons and then go to a place called Akihabara where they sell all the electronic goods and buy gadgets.
They have massive stores there, right? You can buy all
Yeah, you can buy everything.
Robots.
Robots, everything electronic, everything. And I noticed slowly it disappeared, which is rather nice, so I don't care about those things now. So yes, I think it's quite helpful not to want so much. And quite ecologically sound too, isn't it, really? I mean, what do we need, really? Make a list of what you need to live, and then make a list of what you have. And match the two.
I noticed that, like, lately, the last two retreats, I actually took less clothes or less stuff to the retreats than maybe the first one. You know, probably I was, oh, yeah, do I need this? Do I need this? And then I'm like, no, I don't need that. I don't need that. So I just took the basics.
Yeah.
And so my bag's like lighter and lighter every time I go on a retreat now.
Oh. Soon you'll come without any bag at all.
That's not possible. I need something.
But yeah, psychological baggage too. And I think, you know, when you first meet Buddhism, with all its huge mountain of literature, you want to get. It's natural. You want to get some of that knowledge, or something, go get some books and, you know, read it all. But slowly, it's not so important. It's not so important because you find out what is important. If you find out what is important, then obviously what isn't important becomes clear.
That's true in Zen, but in some schools of Buddhism, there's layer upon layer of complexity, isn't there?
Is that? Oh, I don't know.
I don't know.
keep away.
Well, yeah, but Tibetan Buddhism? I mean, the room is full of colourful iconography.
Yes, I don't know so much about Tibetan Buddhism, but I have a student, Simon Holton, who's been living in Dharamsala for 20 years.
Uh-huh.
And he's an expert on Tibetan Buddhism.
Right.
And he's learning layers and layers of understanding of the human psyche. That seems to me to be important in some schools of Tibetan Buddhism. It's almost like a psychology of the soul, apparently, and of course that must be mirrored with things. So if you look at a Tibetan temple up in the Himalayas or somewhere, there's lots of gadgets, but there are lots of intricate paintings and colours, and so I suppose they go together. But I don't know what that's like.
No, I just see it from the outside and sort of run around mine. Because it just, yeah, the complexity just doesn't... I don't find it helpful. Obviously they do, people do.
So. Yes, well, you know, Simon's very committed and he can see the...
value in it.
Value of what we do as well. He'll have to make a choice one day. No, you won't. Lovely bloke. But I suppose I'm naturally quite minimalist in a way.
You can't take much up a mountain.
Well, you have to work out what you need and what you don't need.
The bare minimum.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Was Asteroid like that, the Sinclair, I don't know if I'm familiar with the name, but it's something he's in recent books, he's touched on a few times, which struck me as...
Did you say who?
Ian Sinclair.
Oh, okay.
Writes a lot of books about London, but I guess because he's getting on a bit now, he's up in his 70s, but he's possibly really optimistic spins, but on sort of dementia, be a sense of the end of life stuff, and in a sense that's what happens, is that you're kind of shedding psychological baggage, stuff you don't need, unnecessary memories and stuff like that, you're clearing out, actually, it's a natural organic process.
I don't think it needs to be any kind of intentional practice.
No.
I mean, you know, some people's photographs of their life are very, very important to them. Anything reminds me of the past or anything like that. You don't need to go that far, but I think you may find that if you practice Zazen for some years, that naturally you're not so interested in accumulating. Unless you happen to be a Zen museum curator. In which case, then probably would.
Or Iliana.
She's a library.
Yeah, the library.
But sometimes you need to do it to realise you don't need to do it anymore. Mm. Like me with all my gadgets.
Mm. She's just posted up a thing on Facebook saying how important it is to surround yourself with far more books than you're ever going to be able to read.
Did she take the pictures of the 14 books she
has? Got quite a mass of books, yeah.
I tried this trendy digital nomad lifestyle for a couple of years, where you just work from your laptop and you have like a backpack and you travel that way. But actually, it was really, people who do that are really privileged. Like, oh, I only have one t-shirt, my backpack, and there's like long discussions of forums which t-shirt you should buy $100 which you can like wash every day for a year, you know. And then you can like, and I'm, you know, on the beach and somewhere exotic, and but then next year I'll go back to England and be a barrister again, like, you know, like
digital nomad.
Yeah
So it's kind of lifestyle, isn't
it? Lifestyle, yeah. Like, there's magazines for that. There's, like, website where you can track people.
Clothes.
Right. Yeah, like, because you're in the country, you don't speak the language. Somebody has to sell you a place to work. Somebody has to sell you a place to live. Somebody has to sell you, like, a place to hang out with a lot of people you like. Like, from a commercial perspective, it's a big market. Because people are in vacuum. They just have, like, their backpack, their laptop. The money comes in from their laptop.
It's a commercial opportunity.
Sell lots of stuff to them, yeah. It's nice. People are disconnected from anything, but they have money. Yeah.
So you've tired of that?
It was worth doing.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Definitely lost shape, like shed some layers.
Mm-hmm.
I realize my teenage dreams. But that's it.
Well, you know, going travelling is quite useful in that respect. You can put all your stuff in boxes and leave them in a friend's attic or something, and then you come back, you think, oh, I didn't touch them for a year.
But and then your friend's got all your stuff. Sorry, I'm speaking as a parent of a child who's dumped all his stuff on us and gone off and come back, and we've said, have it back. No,
oh,
thank
yeah.
you.
Well, that's right. Well, what you should
do... throw it away, do they?
That's right.
No,
if you want
to
throw it out,
throw it away.
What you should ask them. Now that you're enlightened about the value of minimalism, you should say to them, I am a Zen practitioner, and I'm your father, and I don't think you need this stuff, so I threw it away.
His 10-foot-high pile of Kerrangs and magazine and rock music.
Oh, yeah, sorry, no,
yeah, sorry.
Records are different.
I should have listened to this.
No, you know, it's strange what is important to us.
Yeah.
Sometimes we don't know until we haven't got it and then we notice.
I've realised he's probably going to listen to this.
Depends what Matt does with it.
I can edit that bit out.
Don't worry. It would be good for him.
But typically in ancient Japan, monks had very few possessions. A bowl, oh no, five bowls, a set of five bowls, orioki, a staff, a robe, or three robes, so that you could put one on top of the other when it was cold, like layers. Layering is not new. And they slept in the zendo, so, you know, move your zafu out the way and sleep. That was in medieval times, which it must have been much easier to have little, because not many people had much more than that anyway. But now we're drowned in objects, aren't we? Drowned in possessions. And I don't think modern society is our friend, really. My friend, anyway. I shouldn't seek for anybody else. I don't think it's friendly to living peacefully, because it demands things of you. You should earn money and then recirculate it. And recirculate it means buying things, and then you have to throw them away, and then buy more. And that machine is a generator of wealth, which that wealth is then migrates upwards. Well, that's not a very nice system to live in, really. So I don't see society as my friend, although I don't want to do anything illegal. Well, I don't want to do too much.
Do say more, you're being recorded.
No, I'm serious. You know, if you're not careful, you can imprison yourself in the system that has been created for a specific purpose.
It's what it wants you to do, isn't it? To be imprisoned in it. Yeah.
A really horrible example of that recently is with the phones. Compulsory updates for phones now. You can't just have a smartphone and go on using it, complaining it until it wears out, or indefinitely. I have an out-of-date iPhone and that I inadvertently wiped all the lost all my photos and information from when I was trying to get it back, and I took it to the place, you know, like the iPhone, you know, Mac store in the Covent Garden. And I went in there with this discontinued model. And there was like called security on me. Like,
what?
Well, they were just, you know, they read me this stuff. I was just trying to ask how I could get my information back from this thing. I'm not very technically savvy, but this is a discontinued model, and they sort of read me this sort of stuff about how they weren't responsible for my data and everything, and they sort of showed me this stuff. And I see them looking around, and there's some people. There's this other thing, people being to the Max Club, there's this thing called the Genius Bar.
Oh, yes.
And I've got 20-year-olds in T-shirts kind of.
Oh, disgusting.
Geniuses, yeah.
Just one T-shirt.
It was fine. A mate of mine gave it to me years ago. Works fine, actually. Text and phone, take photos and stuff like that. I like that aspect of a smartphone, but just like some texts and phone calls, and it would probably last me the rest of my life. If it about there's an accident trying to download it via iTunes and crash the bloody thing. So, but the contract, you almost got contractually obliged to upgrade every sort of year or two. And if they discontinue a model, you can't use it anymore. So it's just landfill, really. It's horrible and insidious. I hate the whole idea of upgrades. It should be kind of, it's not an upgrade.
It's progress.
But the batteries, Apple admitted the batteries are not made to last, so it's a kind of built-in obsolescence.
Yeah, but you couldn't buy a new battery. I mean, if it's not...
Sorry?
Why can't you just get a new battery?
I don't know. But they rig it up, so you've got to buy a new whole phone.
But the way people have bought into this whole thing about phones is like, well, yeah, the phone's crap on it. And it's not crap on it. It still works. It's just, it hasn't got as much... The resolution's not as...
I'm going to invent a Buddhist phone, a Zen phone, which lasts forever. You never upgrade it, and infinite storage, and a Zazen timer built in.
After my after the iPhone died, for a little while I borrowed this kind of old my partner had this old Nokia from 2004, which I was going around with this thing. It's really bloody frustrating because it just felt. I don't know, just because I'm used to using sort of modern technology, this stuff so antiquated, like it's really complicated text, and it's sort of you store about 10 texts and you have to sort of delete them all, and it was so clumsy to use. I felt it was depressing how much I felt I needed to get a new smartphone, which I've just done.
You gave in,
yeah.
Well, that's what people do. It's what we all do.
If it had been 2004, this thing would have felt like state of the art, and I would have been really so happy. So the sense of what you need is so comparative to what everyone else around you has got.
Yes.
Isn't it? I mean, it's,
yes. And that's the society that we live in. I don't think it's very friendly to people, really.
It's not to the environment either, is it? The plastics are really a real problem these days.
There's some mineral we use in touch screens to make, I forget what it's called, that stuff, but it's mined in some region of Africa that's been absolutely
Congo, I think. It's in the Congo.
Yeah.
Warring different warlords fight for control of different mines. There's never one governing power that controls it all. It's just one steps over the next. And something eight, it's called.
Yeah,
it goes into most of our mobile phones.
It's causing some ecological devastation in that region of Africa.
It's all slave labour as well. All young children. Abuse.
Oh dear.
There's a thing you can buy called Fairphone, which is actually all modular. You can replace the camera without replacing the rest of the phone.
But they have
and it's all of like fair trade stuff, but it costs like... it doesn't cost that much compared to an iPhone, actually.
But they had problems, because they were on Facebook, and they had a lot of complaints with the Fairphone 1, because the people that were making the battery for it stopped making the battery. So all of a sudden, this modular phone that was wonderful, that you could keep replacing everything, you couldn't get replacement batteries for it, and therefore you had to buy them.
Do you notice the way that we've honed in on this, talking about phones?
Listen,
do you know why? Because we're all partly trapped in phones.
Mm-hmm.
So we're expressing our frustration with an iPhone. And see how much frustration there is.
Just made phone calls, and I got an incredible stick for it, just having a phone that doesn't have a screen, and you just call people with it.
Right.
So I was forced by my family to upgrade to a
right.
Hounded mercilessly till I gave up.
Right. Well, if you attain the ninth level, you can have the mystical power of telecommunication with other bodhisattvas.
Yeah.
I recommend it. It's far better than any phone. No, anyway, seriously.
That's the problem.
I don't know, let's finish on discussion on iPhones. But seriously, Dogen writes in one chapter, not in these words, we think our family are our friends, but they're not always our friends. And in the same way, we can say, we tend to think that society is there for us, but it may not be. That's all.
It may not have our best interests at heart.
Okay, yeah.
Say that. You know.
Yeah. However, it's no solution to go and live in a hut in the mountains.
Is that what sanghas are for?
Pardon?
Is that what sanghas are for?
Sanghas?
Not to say that a sangha has a purpose, but yes.
In Sanskrit, sangha means
community
or association.
Yeah.
What are communities for?
You said society is, we can't assume that society is on our side. I can't think. Yeah?
Yes.
And is not that what sanghas are about, actually having communities, making contact with other
people
who are like-minded?
Oh, yes. Yes, of course, yes.
Mm.
Or people on the same path.
Same path,
whatever,
same
however
way.
You like to put it.
Yeah. I mean, this not talking about me, but this whole weekend has been, in a sense, revisiting a past, because I came here a long time ago and I was involved with the Quakers back then. And the reason I got involved with the Quakers was because and that was before I got into Zen, I felt very on the outside of society because I had ideals which were ecological and Holy Spirit, Christian terms, Holy Spirit based, as opposed to mainstream, as I was brought up, Methodist Christianity. And so I was looking for like-minded people and eventually identified the Society of Friends, the Quakers, as people that were equally as crazy as me at their best. And it was, it was amazing to find them.
Yeah, we
all
search for people who have similar, we're on a similar path.
Similar path, yeah.
So that's what a sangha is.
Yeah.
Yeah. I suppose what I'm saying is maybe
Well, if you look back, you can see that traditionally Buddhism has always been on the edges of society, not outside, but not inside. So there are quite a few stories of Zen masters turning down,
get offers from the emperor.
Offers of position and so on. So I suppose what I'm trying to say is that whatever Buddhism is, it has its own position, which is not necessarily in the middle of society. Anyway, it's 12:15, so this is getting to just towards the end of our discussion times. Go on.
Have you ever been on a solitary retreat?
No.
I find it quite appealing. Like, I want to spend a week in a hut by myself. Like, what could possibly
go?
What could possibly go wrong?
Well, the fact
there's
that
no society.
The fact that you're asking me and letting everybody know sounds a bit suspicious.
You said that if you spend time in a hut, then something would go wrong. Like, it's not an answer. Living in a hut in a hermit is not an answer.
Well, it might be for you. I don't mean, I only meant that quite generally. You know, if you think that you can go and live somewhere, a divorce from society because it's all getting up your nose, you may find that you're in your little hut with the same person that you were with when you were in society. That's all.
There's no escape.
No escape, that's right, yeah. But no, I mean, some people might be very happy.
There are plenty of huts around attached to other places where you can go and sit on your own.
Yes.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you look at Dogen's history, he was on the fringe. His background was in the imperial court, but he lived out in the sticks. I'm pointing out that maybe the Buddhist life, whatever that is not necessarily centered right in the middle of society. That's all. Because especially modern society is not always our friend. But anyway, thank you all for taking part and listening to me and asking questions and making comments.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.